Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Economic insecurity is relative. Many of you in Southern California, I know, are worrying about layoffs, many of us are, and financial security. Although, when you look at it, more than 1 billion people worldwide are living on less than a dollar a day. Irene Kahn, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, believes such poverty is not just an economic problem, but a global human rights violation. Her latest book, The Unheard Truth, Poverty and Human Rights, is the centerpiece of Amnesty International's three-year human rights campaign to end world poverty. Kahn asserts that the best strategy is to empower the poor to take control of their own lives, enabling them to build a sustainable and dignified future for themselves. Irene Kahn grew up in Bangladesh, and her activist worldview was shaped in part by human rights abuses that occurred during the Bangladesh Liberation War. She's a graduate of Harvard Law School and began her career as a human rights activist with the International Commission of Jurists in 1979. She began working at the UN in 1980 and spent 20 years at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She joined Amnesty International in 2001 as its Secretary General. And as the first woman, first Asian, and first Muslim to serve as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, she's brought a strong focus for socioeconomic rights and violence against women around the world. She's been awarded the Pilkington Women of the Year Award in 2002, as well as the Sydney Peace Prize in 2006. In conversation with Irene tonight, we have another wonderful human rights activist, David Kaye, who's the executive director of the UCLA School of Law International Human Rights Program. For more than a decade, David has served as an international lawyer with the U.S. State Department. He was a legal advisor to the American Embassy in The Hague, where he worked with international criminal tribunals and acted as counsel to the U.S. in several cases before the International Court of Justice and the UN-U.S. Claims Tribunal. The State Department has honored him with four of its prestigious Superior Honors Awards. We're delighted to have both of them here tonight. We're going to begin tonight with a film which was produced by CNN for Amnesty International, after which Irene and David will join us on stage. Afterwards, Irene will be signing her books in the lobby, courtesy of our library store. We'll have the film begin, and afterwards you'll join me in welcoming Irene and David to the stage. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for being here. My name is David Kaye, and I'm pleased to be initiating this discussion with Irene Kahn today. And I asked her if she might initiate our conversation by reading a paragraph from her book, which I thought really spelled out in a lot of ways what the crux of the problem is. And if you would, that would be great. It's at page 21.
Thank you. Yes. Poverty is not primarily about economics and income levels. It is about the powerlessness experienced in so many ways by those living in poverty. Human rights are claims that the weak advance to hold the powerful to account, and that is why poverty is first and foremost about rights. Though many acknowledge the rights dimension, too little effective action follows. Dominant global efforts to eradicate poverty are trapped in a frame of reference that focuses primarily on growth, in which rights are seen as obstacles or mere slogans that can be invoked without consequence. In fact, unless and until the rights dimension to poverty is acknowledged and acted on, I believe these global efforts will make little sustained progress.
Thank you, Irene. So you've written this very powerful book, and it's also very meaty. There's quite a bit in this, and I want us to be able to talk a little bit about the problem that you've identified here, a little bit about the solutions that you've also identified, and then we could also talk a little bit about the barriers to reaching those solutions. But before we get there, you know, reading this book and reading about, and it's a bit of a downer, of course. I mean, it's about a terrible crisis in our world that's been ongoing for decades. Imagine that you were writing a book on the same topic 10 years, 20 years from now. What is the book that you imagine that you should be writing? What is the world that you want to describe rather than the world that you've described in this past paragraph?
Well, if I were to write this book in 20 years' time, I hope I would be writing about the history of poverty, how poverty became part of our history, just as today we look back at the slave trade or even apartheid and talk about it as something that happened way back then and how people struggled and succeeded. And I hope I would write about the struggle towards success.
So let's talk about some of those problems that are out there right now.
Well, one, you know, when I came to Amnesty International, I came with a mandate to promote economic, social, and cultural rights. And very soon afterwards, of course, 9/11 happened. I joined Amnesty in August 2001. And 9/11 happened, and, you know, the focus was very much on the traditional civil and political rights. But what stayed with me was an incident or an event very early in September 2001 during a trip I made to Durban to attend the World Conference Against Racism. And the Amnesty researcher who came out with me took me to a local police station to show me how Amnesty did research. And at the police station, we met a counselor. Just shortly before that, the South African government had introduced a law on domestic violence. The South African legislation is one of the most progressive pieces of legislation on domestic violence. And as part of that law, they had put counselors in police stations to help women submit complaints. And this counselor told me the story of Rosie. And I put it in my book there because I think it encapsulates so much of what poverty is about. Now, Rosie was a poor woman living in one of the black neighborhoods. And she was regularly brutalized by her husband, and he beat her once so badly that she died. I asked the counselor, why didn't Rosie get a protection order? Under the new legislation, protection orders are extremely easy to get. And the counselor replied, Rosie didn't have the bus fare to go from her home to the magistrate's court. And that made me realize that even the best laws of the land aren't able to protect the poor. But it also made me realize that this wasn't just about income. You know, Rosie's story is not just about the fact that she didn't have the money. It's about the insecurity in which she lived. It was about the lack of education and skills that she had, which didn't give her an option to get out of poverty. And so from there, I think one is almost a starting point for this book, which says that people are poor not because of how little they earn. They are poor because of the insecurity with which they live. This insecurity can be because your landlord might evict you, you're living in a slum with no title deeds, no tenancy security. It could be because of job insecurity. You may be a day laborer and don't know whether you're going to have a job the next day. It can be because of the kind of violence that I just mentioned, domestic violence. It can be because of high crime in your neighborhood, or simply because, you know, like in the favelas in Brazil, the police will shoot first and ask questions afterward if you're living in a poor neighborhood. So there is insecurity, but there is also discrimination. And a very high proportion of the poor tend to be women. 70% of women are poor, and that's not just a coincidence. And among the poor, you find indigenous peoples, you will find minorities, ethnic minorities, religious minorities in some countries. And there is also discrimination against the poor because they are poor. So it kind of traps them in poverty. And then the point that I make in the book very much is about the voicelessness of the poor, that they are not heard. you know, in this country, if you're homeless, you don't have a vote. But in other parts of the world, you're not heard because you simply don't have the political power. You're just without clout, and so no one cares about you. And when you look at those issues of discrimination, of insecurity and voicelessness, and the deprivation that you also suffer because you don't have the income, you may be deprived from, you know, healthcare because you can't pay for insurance, or you may have no access to schools because you can't pay for school fees for your kids. That's the combination, you know. And these issues, to me, are human rights issues, and that's why poverty is a human rights problem. And one issue reinforces the other, so it's a kind of a downward spiral.
Talk a little bit. I think it's interesting in how you described, and very sad how you described, the story of Rosie, and about the lack of access to law, the lack of access to any mechanisms of justice in order to effectuate any rights that they might have. So they might have a right on paper, but they have no way to achieve that. Imagine that you're a delegate for Amnesty and you go to the South African government. What is the South African government, or we could say hypothetically, any government's response going to be in that situation? Is it going to be that they can't do it because of resource issues or time or focus? Is it going to be because of social discrimination issues? How does that conversation go?
Well, there are a whole host of excuses that are put forward for not tackling poverty. They will say, of course, economic and social rights. They'll say, well, you know, it's a resource issue, it's expensive, we are a poor government, we can't invest in that. They might say, well, economic and social rights are not real rights. You know, we are not deliberately keeping people poor. It just happens. It's part of the overall economic system. But, you know, and those types of arguments don't really wash. When it comes to resources, of course governments have a choice. The governments have a choice to invest in police systems or in judicial systems. The right to fair trial is not a cheap right. It's quite expensive to have a fair trial. So there are choices being made. And in poor countries, the choice is not between fair trial and education. The choice is actually between buying the latest kind of bomber or tanks or guns and investing in education. So there are very specific choices that governments are very often making that deprive people, that deprive the poor. And because the poor don't have a big role to play in the political system, what they are missing out doesn't get reflected. So there's no mean; they don't have the means to hold their government to account or to put pressure on their government to meet their needs. But there is a tendency to believe that economic and social rights are not real rights. That's one argument. And on the other side, there are others who would say, well, we can only get development if we suppress rights.
Both of those are very interesting, both the non-bindingness mm-hmm. of these kinds of rights and then the question of, we can't afford yeah. to deal with human rights. So I want to deal with the second one first. And you spend a really very deeply interesting portion of the book talking about China. Mm-hmm. This is in your bread, not ballots, bread yes. over ballots yes. Section. And then you compare it to India. And I wonder if you might draw that out a little bit. What is it that China is doing that is both positive but also negative in a sense of generating rights and respecting rights, while at the same time there seems to be this this image of China as also moving forward economically? To what extent is that image wrong? And what is it that China is not doing right? Yes. But that India might be doing?
Well, China, of course, is an economic giant, a global power, and because of China's success in pulling millions of people out of poverty, it is often said, the Chinese government, for a start, will argue that it has been able to pursue that kind of economic growth because it has suppressed civil and political rights. Now, there is no evidence. In writing this book, we did a lot of research and we couldn't find any evidence that suggests that there is a direct connection between China's economic success and China's political strategies to suppress civil and political rights. So the suppression of rights is not why China is doing well. There are many other reasons why China is doing well, but certainly that is not the reason why it's doing well. On the contrary, there is a downside to China's economic progress that doesn't get attention, and that downside is first the big mistakes that have been made in the development process. The famine, the Great Famine, is one example of it. In recent years, the way in which the Chinese have ignored the spread of HIV infection. There was last year a big scandal about melamine in milk powder, which didn't come to light. So a lot of children fell ill and died. So there is a whole history there of mistakes that the government has made, for which poor people in China have paid the price. And when authoritarian governments make mistakes, there isn't any system to correct it fast, because it's not democratic, it's not transparent, you can't criticize your government, you can't speak about it. So it takes these governments a very long time to correct mistakes, if they want to correct them. Many of them don't. The other story of China's economic growth is the inequality. Growth brings inequality. In China, the inequality ratio is 30 to 1. In the United States, it's 16 to 1. And in China, there are people in the rural areas who haven't benefited at all from economic progress as compared to people in the coastal areas. Within cities, you see the migrants who come from rural areas to work in the cities, who don't benefit from healthcare, who don't benefit from regular housing, who don't benefit from education. I mean, their children can't go to schools in the cities. They have to be sent back to the villages. So there is a lot of inequality and injustice that's taking place in China that doesn't get exposed. Now, if you look at India, that's an economic giant too. And of course, in India, there are also human rights abuses and major ones. But there is also a system, because it's a democratic society, an open society, there's a system with an independent judiciary, a free media, there is a system by which issues are coming to light. Now, both of them are making economic progress. And then it becomes a question, almost a values question, of which set of values do you adopt to build your country? And to my mind, I think the democratic approach, the approach that respects human rights and that has open and transparent systems, is probably more sustainable, because inequalities will create tensions and there has to be some mechanism for handling it.
There's a risk, right, in talking so much about rights as a mechanism to alleviate poverty, in which you're almost risking instrumentalizing rights. So what I'm hearing is that it's also a values choice. It's not just about the instrumental value of the rights. It's also about the value of the rights per se.
That's right. There is what I'm saying is, you know, the rights are a good, a smart way of governing a country, but rights are also the right thing to do.
So let me sort of step back and go to the other question, the one on more general, a little bit more esoteric in a way, the economic, social, and cultural rights. And I want to address this in two different ways, or ask you to address it in two different ways. So the first is, and you talk about this in the book in a very clear way that I would assign to my law students, actually, where you distinguish between the ICCPR, that's the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the Economic and Social Rights. And it's clear in those first set of rights, the civil and political rights, the ones where amnesty really got its start in the early 60s, that those are written in a way that are binding on states. They're more or less clear and specific. Whereas the economic and social rights, to which the United States itself is not even a party, although China is a party, for example, they're written in a more general, they're binding, but they're very general, and it's clear that something was going on, that states are, for some reason, more willing to allow civil and political rights, at least on paper, but not the economic and social rights. How do you explain that? Why is it that states are so reluctant on the economic and social side?
Well, you know, if you look at the history and you go back to 1948 and the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That declaration doesn't make any distinction between economic and social rights and civil and political rights. It has the whole list there. The right to education as much as the right to free speech is there. And that document, one of the key architects of that document was Eleanor Roosevelt. And of course, it was President Roosevelt who talked about the four freedoms, freedom from want alongside freedom from fear. And one has to recognize that the world leaders, what were they coming out of at that time? They were coming out of the Second World War, and they were coming out of the economic depression here in the United States. So for them, it made complete sense to have both sets of rights recognized and acknowledged, because that's what people needed in order to lead a dignified life. What happened after 1948, of course, was the Cold War. And as the Cold War set in, you got two sets of ideologies on the international stage. You had the socialists on one side and the capitalists on the other side. And that's when the United Nations decided to adopt two different covenants, with the socialist states, led by the Soviet Union, promoting the covenant on economic, social, and cultural rights, and the Western democracies promoting the covenant on civil and political rights. So it was a false dichotomy that was created for purely political reasons. There was nothing inherently appropriate as a right in right to education as opposed to free speech. But that's the way it happened. And I think Amnesty, to some extent, fell into that trap as well, because when Amnesty was created in 1961 and Amnesty looked at the issue of prisoners of conscience, Amnesty put its resources into promoting civil and political rights because it was dealing with prisoners, political prisoners and prisoners of conscience. And it gave the impression that somehow economic and social rights were lesser rights. But the reality is, in reality, it is not so. And one good example of that is that, you know, many of these economic and social rights are part of the constitutions of many countries. In India and in South Africa, courts have applied economic and social rights in exactly the same way that courts in this country hold up civil and political rights. So there is nothing inherently less legal or less rights-oriented in the two sets of rights.
Why is it then that states still seem, even these many years after the Cold War, are reluctant to implement so many of the economic and social rights?
Well, I think here in the United States, it's become a politicized debate. I mean, you have right now a debate about the right to health care, in a sense, it's kind of ignores. And very often, it's an issue. Very often, I think these debates about rights, which are linked to allocation of resources, are then linked to the way in which power is distributed in society. If you think of the US and the rights situation in the 50s and 60s, of course, here in this country, you had a large part of your population that was not benefiting from rights. And you know the Civil Rights Act, I think, in the 60s. So you had a civil rights movement there because people were being deprived of rights. And in most societies, you find that where economic and social rights are not being respected, it's very often because of discrimination that exists, by which large numbers of people are outside the system, and those in power are reluctant to share the resources, because implementing rights means sharing resources. Yes, you want to have a police system and you want to have a good judicial system and a criminal justice system because you want safety and security in your rich neighborhoods. But you don't want to ensure water as a right, because that would mean supplying poor neighborhoods as much as rich ones. And, you know, as long as you can keep the water for the rich, why share it with the poor? So there are, I think, political decisions that are being made behind this guise of resources and practical and utilitarian arguments.
So rights are often sort of framed as what a government owes to a person, and much of what the book is about is what governments owe to individuals. To what extent is social discrimination an element here as well? And I guess this might be a way to segue into some of the solutions, because that seems to be an area, particularly when you talk about the untouchables and different castes, where there's very severe social discrimination that's even on top of government discrimination. Yes. To what extent is that a problem, and what are the solutions there?
Yes. Well, you know, as if you see rights as legal text, then the relationship between the state and the citizen becomes very prominent. But if you see rights as values, then you see the relationship or the duty or the obligations that each one of us have to respect the rights of the other. And I have a chapter in the book about maternal mortality. That's basically women, you know, in simple language, women dying in childbirth or for pregnancy-related reasons. And I have other parts of the book about gender violence and discrimination against women. And yes, there is legal discrimination, but there is also huge social discrimination that keeps women in poor, that keeps women neglected. If you take the issue of maternal mortality, there are customs and sort of traditions that deprive women of health care. Issues, you know, in countries, I was in Sierra Leone about a month ago, and there is a law that forbids child marriage in Sierra Leone, and yet girls as young as 13 were in the maternity hospital with ruptured uteruses because they'd been married, got pregnant, and were not physically able to have babies. That was part of the culture and custom, and that's the way society was behaving. Of course, the government and the state turned a blind eye to it, and that allowed these customs to persist. Social discrimination is very much a part of this story, but it's also what responsibility do the powerful have towards the powerless. And when I talk about the powerful, I talk about political leaders. I talk about community leaders, too.
And what is Amnesty? What do you perceive as your role in moving that conversation forward and moving away from the social discrimination?
Well, the first thing you have to do is, first of all, you have to have the right laws in place, because that's an indication, that's a sort of a benchmark for behavior. Secondly, you have to make sure that those laws are being implemented. And thirdly, I think there is a role for political leadership and for social leadership to make the point about what's the right thing to do. And that's very often missing. I mean, when we look at issues of refugees or migrants, you know, the kind of political statements that are made by our leaders does make a lot of difference to how we regard migrants. You know, so I think there's a leadership issue here underlying the book very strongly.
So before we get into maybe a little bit more deeply into some of the solutions, I wanted to ask you whether... I think one of the criticisms of any human rights organization that's global in scope is, how are you going to narrow down your focus so you can identify some achievable goals? And I was wondering whether there are particular areas in the world, sort of globally, where there are the most serious crises where you think the human rights community needs to focus, or two or three areas in particular. And then on more of a programmatic level, are there particular areas within or under the umbrella of poverty where you think the human rights community really needs to focus? So both regionally and programmatically.
Yes. Well, in my book, I have picked three issues. And one of them is maternal mortality. And that is the severity of it, that in this day and age, 500,000 women die while giving birth. That's simply unacceptable. And in my book, there is a part where actually I say that there are more women dying while giving birth than there are people being tortured or people who have disappeared. And yet the human rights community has engaged with issues of torture and disappearances much more actively, proactively than they have with issues of maternal death. So to me, this is a travesty of justice, a travesty of rights of women. And that's one issue that I've picked up. The second issue that I focus on in the book is about slums. And I pick on that because there are 1 billion people living in slums today, and that number will double by 2030. And there is very little awareness around the world of what that means in terms of health, sanitation, water, security in the heart of some of the largest urban conglomerations in the world. Slums are created partly because of economic growth, people coming from poor parts of the rural areas to make a living in the city. Slums are also created because of human rights abuses. People who are being pushed off their land, landless peasants who are pushed off their land, will make their way into the city. In Africa, many of the slums have been the result of conflict, war, in the countryside that has pushed people into the cities for safety. And yet these people have no recognition there. They're totally unrecognized. I mention in the book Kibera in Kenya, the largest slum, which you will have seen in the film, which I visited in June this year, where I was amazed to see water pipes running through that slum. Kibera is the largest slum in Africa, by the way. 1 million people live in Kibera in the heart of Nairobi. And I saw water pipes running through the slum, you could see it visually, supplying the rich neighborhoods with clean water, and yet people in the slums had no access to water. The land is government land, and others have come in and built shacks, and then rented those shacks out to the people who are living there now at exorbitant rents. And they can be pushed off out of those shacks at any moment. It can be destroyed, demolished. There were other places where demolitions are underway because these slums are now on very valuable development land. So you have a whole cycle of human rights abuse that's taking place right in the heart of the city. As the world is becoming more urbanized, the majority of the world's population now is urban, and nothing much is happening. And that's why I think we need to focus on the issue of slums. And the third area that I focus on in the book is about the responsibility of corporations, business, economic interests. And I look particularly at the extractive industry in Africa, because Africa is a resource-rich continent, and yet the countries that are most rich in natural resources very often tend to be the countries where there are the worst conflicts and worst human rights abuses that are taking place. And those conflicts are very much linked to the economic interest, whether it's in Chad or Guinea or the Democratic Republic of Congo or Angola or Nigeria. You see corrupt governments colluding with greedy business. And the result of that is that people are pushed out and don't benefit from the wealth that is coming into their own country. And that, of course, then leads to social tensions, leads to conflict, and you see the cycle of violence happening. And yet our international system is not ready to recognize the human rights responsibilities of economic actors. So that's a big gap, I think, in the legal system that exists and that needs to be plugged. So I'm looking at three very different issues, but they are all burning issues. I think there is a burning platform. I think they create a burning platform for change. And that's why I think those are three important issues for the human rights community to focus on. And those are the three issues, incidentally, that Amnesty hopes to focus on in its Demand Dignity campaign that you just saw the clip about.
So I want to move to solutions. I also want to assure everyone here that there's a committee in about 5 or 10 minutes. We'll move to questions. Because I'm sure yours will be more articulate than mine. But I want to, so in moving to the question of solutions, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the international financial institutions, the World Bank, and others who in the human rights community and the development and rights-based communities have been the target of quite a bit of criticism. I mean, you had to have been asleep for the last 15 years to miss it. What role do you see for the World Bank, for the IMF, for USAID, for other institutions that are really focused on development? And I think your critique is pretty trenchant in there, where it's all about development and it's not about rights. As you're moving your platform along, what kind of conversations are you having with these institutions? And do you see them moving sort of in lockstep with you to try to achieve the goals that you're, at the end of the day, both want to achieve these goals?
Well, one of the critiques that I have is the way in which poverty is defined in terms of income. You know, the World Bank's definition of poverty is $1 a day or $2 a day. When you define poverty in terms of income in that way, then the natural tendency is to see the solution as being a solution of economic growth. And as I said before, I mean, economic growth brings along with it economic inequalities. It marginalizes people, pushes people out. And the question that one constantly needs to ask is, who's being left behind? As human rights activists, I think that's a question that we always ask, who's being left behind? So when I've opened conversations with these institutions, I have found, to my surprise, and you will see in the book, a lot of research and analysis done by the World Bank itself shows that human rights matter when it comes to development projects. Those projects where human rights were incorporated have done better than those where they were not. The World Bank did a document called The Voices of the Poor in the late 90s, which interviewed 60,000 people, poor people. And it was very clear from what they were saying was basically what I'm saying in my book. So what I'm saying in my book is not new. And yet the World Bank, having made the analysis and the evaluation, having heard the voices of the poor, then in their poverty reduction strategy guidelines say, well, yes, of course, issues of participation are important, but they are very tricky. And therefore, they may not be given as much prominence. The problem, and that's where the problem lies. You know, they see these as political issues, tough issues, controversial issues, so let's not deal with them. The second problem is that many of these development organizations tend to see participation as a technical point. So it's, yes, people have to participate, you have to consult with people, so you bring a group together, you discuss with them, you tick off your box and say, well, that's done, participation is done. What they don't recognize is that participation is more than that sort of formal conversation. Participation is about controlling the decisions, participating in the decisions that affect your life. And that means promoting open societies. That means recognizing free speech, recognizing freedom to organize. And those are challenging issues for many, many countries. Recognizing freedom of information, making it possible for people to have information. And many of these big donor organizations are just not ready to get into that debate because of the political implications there.
Do you think that some of their aid should be conditioned on meeting rights benchmarks?
Well, I think it's not so much conditioning aid to it, but designing aid in a way in which that is promoted. So designing aid in a way in which freedom of information becomes essential, designing aid in a which, you know, if you take Sierra Leone and maternal health now, there's a lot of attention being given in the last couple of weeks to maternal mortality. There was a conference in Addis last week of health ministers of the world because maternal death figures have not changed since 1992. And when they're having those conversations, they're talking a lot about more money is needed. And of course more money is needed in these health systems in poor countries. But if you just pour money in without at the same time making it possible for women to have a say in the kind of healthcare they need, so that the healthcare actually meets their needs, then of course you're not going to get very efficient health systems. If you don't at the same time improve transparency of governance, then a lot of the money that's going to be passed on will be siphoned off for other purposes and not used for healthcare. So you need to design these health systems entirely on that. So it's not just making it a conditionality thing, because then you have this very tense debate about sovereignty of the kind we now see on Pakistan with the US, but it's much more an overall conversation that needs to take place, and much more a conversation at the multilateral level, so that everyone agrees, and it's not just a bilateral debate. It's not an issue of U.S. foreign policy as to whether or not country X follows human rights. It should be a matter of being part of the international community.
But I'll ask one more question and then open it up to the audience. And I want to acknowledge the generous support of the VESPER organization, which is a multi-faith, interfaith social justice organization. And it brought to my mind a question of whether there are other institutions out there, apart from states, apart from NGOs, but institutions that are philanthropic and aid-oriented, but also faith-based institutions, whether you see a role for those kinds of institutions as well, if this is a kind of coalition that you're hoping to build with all of these different actors.
Well, certainly, Amnesty's Demand Dignity campaign, which we launched a few months ago, and it's a global campaign. It will also be in the U.S. In the U.S., we will be looking at health issues, particularly maternal health, maternal deaths, in fact, in the U.S. Women of color face 3 to 4 times the risk of white women, so it's a big issue here. But we will also do it globally around the world. And it is about coalition building. It's about building coalitions with the development community that have been working on this issue for a very long time. It's about building coalitions with the faith community, which has worked again with poverty issues for a very long time. It's about building coalitions with some governments that want to see change but don't quite know how to do it. It's about building coalitions with those aid institutions, financial institutions that want to change. You know, obviously, we'll have to put pressure on some of them. Some are more willing than others to listen to these issues. So it's about mobilizing people, because unless you mobilize people, you cannot bring about change. That's really the critical issue. And maybe if you allow me to read another paragraph from my book, I would like to read the last paragraph of the book. And the last paragraph says, there are many paths to freedom and no single road to happiness. There is, therefore, no single solution to ending poverty. Respect for human rights is not another strategy. It is rather an essential piece of any strategy. Looking back, I see several key moments in the history of human emancipation: the abolition of slavery, the achievement of universal suffrage and the emancipation of women, the end of colonialism, the victory over fascism, the end of apartheid, the fall of the Berlin Wall. Each struggle has its own history and dynamics. But at the very core of each of these great struggles was the claim that individuals had rights that could not be denied, rights that transcended race, religion, gender, class, or citizenship, and rights that took precedence over any particular economic or political policy. The struggle to end poverty is no less momentous. It is this generation's great struggle. We will win it if we put freedom, justice, and equality at its core.
I think that's a perfect segue for us. It's a perfect opportunity to open it up to questions. And I only want to ask, as I call on you, if you could keep your questions short so that we can allow as many of you to ask questions as possible. I think there's a mic over here, and there's a gentleman right straight in the back here.
One of the things I found in my travels and work in the third world, so-called third world, is the fact that the rich generally don't pay their taxes, and the international aid community enables that. There's never any demand that if the World Bank comes in, you got to pay your taxes before we'll help develop your country.
Well, the issue you're raising is a very important one, and that is about transparency and the fight against corruption, nepotism, you know, abusing your power not to pay taxes, for example. And that's why the key point of my book is about empowering people rather than simply seeing poverty as an issue of enrichment. And I use the example, there's one instance where I show how information, the right to information, has actually transformed people's ability to hold those in power to account. I talk about the situation in India, in Rajasthan, where a number of years ago, workers wanted to know how many hours were being logged in the state-owned factory where they were working. And when they went and asked the foreman for that information, they were told that it was a state secret. It was a state-owned factory, and they used legislation going back to Indian colonial times, British times, which said that any state-generated information is a state secret. And that was the start of a movement, a nationwide movement in India for freedom of information legislation. And the legislation eventually was passed in 2006. I visited India just a few months after that, and I met one of the activists who worked in Rajasthan on this issue. And I asked her what the results was, and she gave me one little concrete example, but you can see what it did. She said that in the village where she was running her project, the government provides food for public works. And now the villagers go and ask the local official how many bags of food was given by the government. And the guy has to show them the dockets. And the dockets say 100 bags. And then the villagers say, but you know, you only distributed 83 bags. So what happened to 17 bags? And it's in that sort of very concrete way people are holding their government to account. So I think if you had more transparency, if you had right to information, if people had the right to demand better governance, then those issues of the rich getting away by not paying taxes would become more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Down here in the front.
I come from Bangladesh, so I'm really very proud that that little country has produced people like Dr. Yunus, Irene Khan, who the world knows, and Mr. Hossein Abid, who the world yet doesn't know. My question is about, you made a statement very recently in which you asked President Obama to take a second look at the Goldstone Report. My question is not why, because that's obvious. My question is about, can you draw the inherent contradictions that exist between American ideal for human rights and its foreign policy implementations? Thank you.
Well, that I think is, it's a struggle that most countries go through, where many countries would believe in human rights but do not apply it, and there's a big gap between the rhetoric and the reality. But I think for the United States in particular, it's a critical issue. The world looks to the United States for leadership. The history of the United States, the Bill of Rights, your struggle here in this country for civil rights, the role that the United States plays today on the world stage, these are all issues that make it so critical that this country live by the values that it espouses and that it expects others to follow. I mean, I studied law here in this country, the rule of law and human rights, first learned about it here, not in my own country, because there, of course, the systems, they don't respect human rights. I think there is a huge chance now. I think there is really a sense of hope and high expectations around the world. I think the Nobel Peace Prize says it all about the expectations that the world has of President Obama and this administration. It's very important that the chapter be closed on the war on terror and the abuse of human rights in the name of counterterrorism, but that a new chapter needs to be opened in which human rights are seen as truly global values. One part of our campaign to demand dignity is going to be a project that will seek recognition of economic and social rights in the United States, economic, social, and cultural rights in the United States, and civil and political rights in China. Because we feel that going ahead, the world needs a unified vision of human rights. And we hope that the U.S. will play its role on this side, just as we expect China to play its role on the other side. So the world is looking to the U.S. for leadership. Whether President Obama will live up to our expectations or not depends very much on us. The extent to which we mobilize, we send the message to him strongly that we will be with him if he follows the path of human rights. That's very, very important. And for an organization like Amnesty, which is a membership-based organization, I hope your voices will be heard. And the American people's voices will be joined by voices from around the world.
I think I'm going to make you run a little exercise this evening, but there's a question over here. I'm in the second row.
Irene Khan, thanks for a wonderful speech today. My question has to do with, you mentioned empowering the people. Now, usually like that 13-year-old girl that you talked about and the million people, women dying of childbirth, the excuse we hear is that this is the tradition, and whether it's religion-based or whatever, how do you overcome that kind of entrenched belief to then forward the human rights for women?
Well, I would say that culture and tradition are not static. They change and they improve, particularly through education, through encounter with other people and other ideas and thinking. And therefore, investment in education is so important. It's the way in which humankind has progressed. So it's very important to do that. When it comes to issues about religion and Sharia and so on, very often I find that these are covers for other purposes. They cover political reasons. I have never, I'm a Muslim and I've traveled extensively in Muslim countries. I've never heard a single Muslim government ever say that they cannot participate in the international financial system because Sharia law does not recognize interest. Right? So that just says it all when it comes to Sharia law and women's rights. It's a question of power. Social power here sometimes and political power. And that's why one needs to challenge those ideas and one needs to invest in education.
So, right here, there's a woman right there, right in front of you. Yes, there's two.
Hi, I'm curious to hear how you see the impact of the recent international economic crisis on the promotion of human rights for the poor. Specifically, has it made things worse because the poor always disproportionately suffer when economic recessions and the like happen and now governments are saying, well, we definitely can't afford to act now? Or has it paradoxically made things perhaps better in that it's delegitimized the whole neoliberal free market economic development model, which, as you point out, hasn't helped the poor in the first place, so maybe it'll actually help?
Well, you know, there were when the economic crisis started, I mean, there was some feeling that it would be mainly restricted to the developed world, but actually it wasn't. Very rapidly, it spread and affected the whole world because we are living in a global economy. And the poorest, of course, are hurt most. I was just speaking today with the gentleman who drafted the United Nations report looking at the impact of the recent economic, the economic recession on poverty. And he said to me that his research showed that the working poor have been worst hit. The chronic poor have been poor before and remain poor, and of course there are less resources for them now. But the working poor, the people who were seeking to pull themselves out of poverty, they have now been hurt very much. So the economic growth model, and particularly, you know, you take, for example, countries that are dependent on migrant, on remittances from migrant labor. When those people lose their jobs and the workers have to go home, then they lose an income, but the country itself also loses revenue. That means the country then has less money to put into health, education, and other sort of social development programs. So everyone suffers. So there's been really a pushback into poverty of millions of people as a result of this economic recession. And the problem with the economic growth theory as an answer to poverty is that the poor are the last to benefit from economic growth and the first to suffer when the bust comes. Now, your next question as to whether we have drawn some lessons from it, I think, more pessimistic on that now. If you had asked me that question about a year ago, I would have said, well, actually, maybe we are going to draw some lessons from it and maybe we will look to change. But when you look around today, you see what's actually happening is the same theory of growth being propounded again. And it's the same investments being made. And, you know, the idea is that if we have enough of a consumer boom, we will all get rich again and there won't be another bust. But we know that that's the way it's happening. And in that equation, the forgotten part is climate change. You know, the sustainability of this planet, which also has to be built in when we are looking at poverty eradication strategies. You know, because otherwise, if there's no planet, then there are no human beings and no human rights issues. But that's why I think we've really missed an opportunity. The economic, you know, every crisis is an opportunity, and the economic crisis could have been handled in a different way to create a more sustainable economy where all of us would benefit. I was in Richmond, Virginia last week, and I visited a soup kitchen there to get a sense of poverty in this country. And there were a lot of people there, people largely people of color, and a lot of men who had lost jobs and others, and I talked to them. And it was amazing how much wisdom there was in that soup kitchen from those guys there. And one guy said to me, he said, look, what's happened to me is not my fault. It happened because some people were too greedy on Wall Street. And he says, but I hope that next time round they remember that if they don't help people like me to get out of the situation I'm in, they can't benefit either. so that they recognize the interdependence of the humankind, and that is reflected in the interdependence of the economy. So if you don't help people at the bottom of the pile, it would be very difficult, actually, to have sustainable progress. And that wisdom came from a man in a soup kitchen.
Your mention of the soup kitchen, actually, it's interesting because I think a lot of people, particularly in our country, think of poverty reduction as something that we do as sort of our pro bono responsibility to our fellow citizens. But what you're talking about is really a broader strategy that's a government on the shoulders of governments.
Yes, that's right, because I think very often it is seen as philanthropy. And that is why it is so important to see health, education, housing, not just as needs or as commodities, but as rights, because that gives a totally different way at which you will look at poverty eradication. And people get empowered when they think they have a right to health care, rather than that it's something, you know, that the market provides or fails to provide.
I mean, you're really talking about a change of perspective, a change of way we think.
Absolutely, right. Absolutely.
So, all the way in the back, up there, and then we'll come
Thank
over
you
here.
Very much. I was really disgusted with what had happened with Wall Street speculators doubling the price of foodstuffs over a period of less than 3 months. And so when you say, like, poverty level is $1 or $2 a day, well, it becomes meaningless when the price of food has doubled in such a short span of time, like in Haiti, where they were eating mud cakes to try and deal with their hunger pains. And it seems like Wall Street is terrorists. They are terrorizing poor people around the globe. And when we propose to feed most of the grain grown in this country, more than 70% is for cattle, and we have blockades against country where we know people are starving. Our government is a terrorist government. I'd like your comment on it.
Well, I think whichever way you look at the world today, we're living in an interdependent world, and that's why we need to recognize not just what's good for us, but what's good for all of us. That does require a different attitude, but it's, to my mind, it's a pragmatic approach as well as a principled approach. Because unless, you know, feeding corn to cattle, for example, what are we doing to the environment in the longer term? So we need to think about those issues more deeply and more holistically. The problem is that governments tend to live from one election to another, and so this sort of holistic policy approach is missing. Now, the other point about taking an interdependent approach to issues is, I think, is very much part of human rights. Human rights are global values. What lies at the heart of human rights is the notion of universal rights. We all have the same rights because we are human beings. So there is there, I think, a way of creating a framework, a global framework, a shared framework of values that if we all subscribe to, we might approach the future in a different way.
So, gentlemen here.
Yes, I'm of a generation that grew up in discrimination. And I must say, it took us 100 years after we passed the 14th Amendment before we got a Civil Rights Act in the United States. And then it was largely ineffective until we passed the Civil Rights Attorney Fees Awards Act, where people could actually get compensation for taking their civil rights to a court. But it took a fearless judge at that time, actually, to go along with that. And I must say also that the United States of America to this day says, well, that's okay if you're just talking about civil rights between ordinary people, but if you're talking about a suit against the United States, judges better be on their lookout. Don't try to award fees against the United States. And so I'm wondering then, what do you have a better model? We obviously need a very strong judiciary in a country. Otherwise, you cannot get enforcement of the laws. But you need, as you said, you need the access to the courts. Is there another country where you would say has a better model?
I think there isn't a country that's got it right yet. I think everyone's got their problems. Problems differ, but they've got problems. I think where we see progress taking place, where we see things a bit better than other places, is where you have courts, but you also have proper laws, but you also have, and above that, you have a framework of international law, of agreed human rights principles. Because, you see, national laws can be changed. National laws can be undermined, and you need a higher set of laws, a higher set of values to which courts can look to when there is a dilemma about, you know, what's the right interpretation. And we've seen, for example, in Europe, where they have a European Convention on Human Rights and they have a European court, we've seen European governments being pushed to higher standards of performance, being taken to task when they have failed to respect rights of refugees or migrants or people in their own country, or where they have, for example, tried to return people to places where they could be tortured. You know, they were taken to task by the international system. And in this country, there is, I think, a reluctance to submit to international rules and international human rights principles. The reluctance of the United States to ratify some key human rights conventions, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. There are only two countries in the world that are not parties to it. It's the United States and Somalia. You take the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Now, the countries that haven't ratified it, Iran, Somalia, Sudan, United States. So, you know, you're in not in very good company there. But what I'm trying to say here is that this country has a great tradition of rights. You know, your legal tradition is a strong and powerful one, and even in recent times, during the last administration, when human rights were being attacked in the name of counterterrorism, the court stood up to that pressure, and there were some very good court judgments that encouraged us, human rights activists. But obviously, that alone is not enough. And because we're living in an interdependent world, we have to have shared values on the basis of which we manage our governance. And those shared values are called human rights, international human rights. And I hope that the United States will recognize the value of signing up to those international treaties and will subscribe to them. Because as I said earlier, the political leadership of the United States would be critical, not just for the United States, but there is a huge export value of what this country does. And you can export bad things or you can export good things. And it's, you know, and so the world is, I think, looking to U.S. for leadership. And I hope if the U.S. Ratifies treaties, and not just ratifies them, but actually implements them, because that's the other issue. It's not enough. There are many countries of the world that sign these treaties and ratify them and don't respect them. But if the United States ratifies them and respects them, then imagine what a wonderful role model that will be for the rest of the world.
You actually mentioned, I want to follow up on that question, because the accountability issue is a big part of the book also. You talk, or you write relatively little about Europe, actually, in the book. And what you just said started to make me think that, well, in some respects, maybe Europe is the model that that you're aiming at, and Europe is positioned to be more of a leader in human rights than the United States. Do you think that's possible, that the United States is in some way at risk of losing that kind of mantle?
Well, I wish I could say Europe was a model, because in my book, actually, I talk about the Roma community in Europe. You know, these are the traveling community, the gypsies. And all over Europe, they are deeply discriminated. There is racism in Europe. There is ill treatment of refugees and migrants in Europe. So I'm not sure that Europe is ready to be a model yet. Europe has human rights values written in the Constitution of Europe, but doesn't always implement them or apply them to its foreign policy. So I don't think Europe is a model in that sense. And it's difficult to point a perfect country, but there are examples where certain things have worked in certain places. I think the most powerful message of my book is that you don't look to human rights protection to the state alone. Human rights protection comes from the empowerment of people. And you have to build civil society. You have to allow people, you know, to demand their rights. And that's the real strength of my book, I would say, this strong plea for empowerment of people. And there are many, and in every chapter, there is a good news story. So the book is not about the misery through which we are living. There's plenty of misery there, yes. There are plenty of human rights abuses that I point out in the book. But I do so in order for us to look at the solutions, in order for us to see how people have organized themselves, whether it is slum dwellers in Cebu City in the Philippines, whether it's the workers in Rajasthan that I just mentioned, whether it's the women of Ciudad Juarez and how they have organized themselves. Throughout the book, there are many, many good news stories, and I think it's important to point that out as well. Things can change. People are working to make a change. The challenge is, how do you scale up? How do you scale up these small efforts that people are making into a global effort? And that's where my book emphasizes the role of the United States, the role of China, the role of the United Nations and its Millennium Development Goals, and how we can, you know, push and improve those goals by injecting a human rights approach to it.
I think we have time for one or two more questions. Yes, right here.
You talk about changing values a lot. Historically, I would argue that the human animal has a very bad track record of being self-centered, short-term thinking, and zero-sum game. Do you agree with that or not? If you do, how do we get from here to there?
Actually, I would disagree with you. I think that, you know, in my time, for the last, I've been in the, if I can call it the human rights business now for 30 years, first as a part of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and now as Amnesty. And traveling around the world, meeting people, I've been struck at the courage of people, but also their selflessness, how much they're ready to sacrifice to improve things, not just for themselves, but for their communities or for others. So, There is somewhere inside us that power to do good and to want to do good, and I think it's very important that we encourage and nurture that power. There are stories in this book about human rights defenders that work under terrible conditions. I talk about a woman called Paulina, who was in Brazil. I met her in Brazil, and who took me into the favelas. And, you know, my Amnesty delegates, my colleagues from Amnesty, stayed outside the favela because they thought that if I went in there, I would never come out alive. But I went in with her, and she showed me the work that she was doing there with all these kids that were being pulled into gun violence because they had no other alternative. They had no other place to look to, and she and others like her were trying to encourage these young people to go into, you know, music and art and more positive issues, education, and get out of the misery that they were living in. Her life was threatened because the drug gangs that were operating in those favelas didn't want her there because she was taking kids out of that system. Amnesty had to take her out of the country for a while for her own safety, but then she went back again, and she's working with other people there to bring about change. So when you see those stories of individual courage, of communities in Colombia, for example, in the Choco area, communities that have worked over the years to protect their land and have created humanitarian safe areas to which people can move when the fighting starts, so people are protected. All sorts of stories throughout the book about individual courage, human courage, that I think makes me optimistic that in the long term we will end poverty. The question is, how long will it take us, and how many of us are going to join that struggle and make it happen?
One more question, back here.
Thank you. My question is actually twofold. You alluded to corporate responsibility a little bit earlier, and I'm actually in an executive MBA program, and we just returned from Southeast Asia, where we were actually discouraged by our program from asking, you know, the more probing questions. I'm curious to know what you're looking to future leaders for, in terms of entrepreneurship and the human rights element. And I also would like to know what you think of what recently occurred in Iran. In Iran, in terms of how the Iranian people dealt with it, how Obama dealt with it, and how other international countries reacted to the post-election.
Well, in terms of business, I think it's important to recognize that as business goes global, there are companies now emerging out of countries which don't have a strong tradition of human rights. I'm talking, for example, of Chinese companies that are going into China to operate there. Now, when it comes to Western companies, there are good companies and not so good companies. And the good companies are good because there's public pressure here. There is a consumer movement, there are questions being asked, and that forces companies to improve their performance. But when they're operating on a global stage, we've had in one particular country, in Sudan, Amnesty campaigned about human rights abuses associated with a particular oil company, a Western oil company. And eventually the company actually pulled out of Sudan. We didn't ask the company to pull out of Sudan. We asked the company to improve the situation, but the company decided to pull out because it figured that it wasn't economically viable for the company, it wasn't good for its reputation, it pulled out. And then the Chinese companies moved in. And, you know, what do you do there? So that's why we are arguing for global standards for all companies, because that will create a level playing field, which is of interest to companies, but it also ensures a level playing field for human rights, too, and not just for business competitiveness. So I think it's important, and when you mention Indonesia, it's important to see those, you know, in those countries' improvement of corporate behavior there. In the context of Iran, this is a country which is a difficult one to tackle because there are security issues. There is this whole debate about whether Iran is arming itself with nuclear weapons or not. But there is an Iranian civil society that is struggling for rights. There is a very strong women's movement in Iran that's organizing itself. And this, you know, Amnesty International has been working closely with many of these women activists. And there are times when they themselves said, look, it's going to be stronger for us to be heard, to have our own voices heard, and we don't want you to publicize our case. At other times, they've come and told us, we need your support. So I think it's very important that we encourage and support the movement that is inside Iran, the voices of people there, and we allow them to take the lead in shaping this kind of society they want.
Well, Irene, I want to thank you for joining us this evening. I think that it's fair to say that the Amnesty logo in your brand, the candle with the barbed wire wrapped around it, is one of the most familiar symbols, not just in human rights, but in modern marketing, if you want to call it that. And Amnesty has been incredibly successful on a range of issues, from prisoners of conscience to human rights defenders to campaign against torture and all that. And I think that on behalf of everyone here, I could say that we want to wish you, of course, success, that you reach the same kind of success that you did on those kinds of issues on this current campaign. But it's really not wishing you success, it's wishing us success as well. I also want to thank the Aloud program. As you leave, you'll notice that there's a place where you can make a contribution to keep conversations like this and guests coming like Irene Khan to Los Angeles and to participate in these kinds of forums with us. So please feel free to do that. But please join me in thanking Irene Khan for this evening.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.